This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
This week on World in Progress, a young man triumphs over prejudice and opens an institute for the blind in Nepal.
It is not very easy because the whole community and the society itself is looking, being blind is not able to do anything.
Colombia's 60,000 missing people are remembered.
If I could just talk to him now, I would tell him how much I love him. But even if he's dead, I want him back.
And German insurance companies come under pressure to extend coverage for victims of genital mutilation.
They have been repeatedly shoved between doctors who don't know about the consequences of genital mutilation and the insurance companies, which wouldn't bear the costs.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Saroja Coelho, standing in for Anka Raspa. We start the show this week with the next in our two-part series on social entrepreneurs with disabilities. Last week, we told you about a school in India which trains blind people around the world how to become leaders in their own communities. Well, this week, we follow one of their students back to his home in Nepal, where discrimination against disabled people is widespread. But the young man we're about to meet hasn't let social barriers hold him back. Isha Bhapatia has this report, which is read by Jesse Wingard.
The Nepalese national anthem is played as hundreds of activists and experts gather for a conference on disability issues at Tripuvan University in the country's capital, Kathmandu. They are here to discuss the challenges faced by disabled people and to dream up new projects to address the needs of their communities. Komra Sharma is blind and has taken part in this annual event for years. He is the founder of the Inclusion Empowerment Centre for Continuing Education in Pokhran, central Nepal. The centre provides blind students with computers and the technology they need to use them. At conferences like this one, Sharma is able to make contact with companies where his students may be able to get job experience.
Since the social attitudes towards blind people is not that positive, it is not very easy because the whole community and the society itself is looking, being blind is not able to do anything. So the students have to prove that they can do. And we are organizing sometimes different workshops where we talk about potentialities of blind and visually impaired students.
As Sharma talks about his work, his face lights up. His enthusiasm and optimism are contagious. In Nepal, it is difficult for visually impaired people to find employment as discrimination against those with disabilities is widespread. Born in a small village in western Nepal, Sharma lost his eyesight when he was just 11 years old. He was born unable to see out of his left eye but had some vision in his right. But without adequate medical care, his condition worsened. His parents, who were peasants and unable to read, took him to a nearby temple in search of help. They were told Sharma's blindness was punishment for something bad he had done in a past life. Being blind in Nepal is considered by many to be a curse. Sharma remembers this as the worst time in his life. He was afraid. When he was finally taken to see a doctor, it was too late. He had lost the sight in both eyes forever. But Sharma says he doesn't blame his parents.
I mean, the whole society was like that, and it was very far from the hospitals even, you know. And since they were not financially even strong, they couldn't do it right away. And so I don't have such of regrets and like that.
Sharma was able to get into a school for the blind and continue his studies. That's where he met the woman he wanted to marry. She was from a lower caste, which means she was considered socially beneath him, and again Sharma found himself fighting against discrimination.
I mean, you know the caste system here in Nepal. There is a caste discrimination, and the person from upper caste are not allowed to get married with the person from lower caste. And I am from so-called upper caste, and she's from this so-called lower caste. I mean, she's from the ethnic minorities or something. So it was somehow very difficult to convince the parents and all.
But the couple did eventually marry and they had a son who is now 3. They named him Vision because he is able to see. Sharma has long been active in disability rights organisations and has become a vocal advocate for the rights of blind people in Nepal. In January of 2009, Sharma was awarded a scholarship and invited to attend the International Institute for Social Entrepreneurs in Kerala, India.
It was 11 months long intensive course, and that was the place where I could learn all these things at once, like project management, planning, fundraising, and all those skills that I learned from there. And that was very good opportunity for me, where I got lots of confidence.
Sharma returned to Nepal in December of 2009 and set about establishing his own education centre for blind people in the city of Pokhara. The classrooms at the Inclusion Empowerment Centre for Continuing Education are small and minimally furnished, but they have been equipped with some of the newest computer technology available. Sharma teaches classes here for free. Blind people in Nepal tend to get very little support from the government and rely heavily on their families. Integrating blind people into the workforce is Sharma's ultimate goal. He says there are blind people working in banks in neighbouring India, something which is still a far-off dream for blind people in Nepal. Sabitri Bhattarai is one of Sharma's students. Blind from birth, she uses a computer equipped with specialised software that allows her to hear what she is typing. Despite the challenges ahead, she has big plans for the future.
Computer teacher and...
I'd like to teach at a computer institute. My friends want me to teach them basic computing skills. I want them to be able to stay in contact with the whole world, even when they're at home.
Students like Bhattarai embody the very spirit of the Inclusion Empowerment Centre. They are encouraged to dream big and break down barriers. Sharma gets inspiration from his homelands, the foothills of the Himalayas near Mount Everest, the world's highest mountain. He says the feeling of being on top of these mountain ranges helps him aim high and stand unshaken in the face of any challenge. That's what he aims to teach others. Jesse Wingard with a report from Isha Bhapatia, Deutsche Welle Radio, Pokhara.
Thank you to Isha Bhapatia for that report. Tuesday marked the International Day of the Disappeared. This year, the day was intended to highlight the difficulties faced by families waiting for news of absent loved ones. Our next report takes us to Colombia. For more than four decades, government forces, rebel groups, and drug cartels have battled for control of large parts of the country. And amid the violence, some 60,000 people have gone missing. As the conflict continues, a forensic institute in Bogota is hard at work to identify the remains which have been discovered and give those left behind a sense of closure. Imogene Fox has more.
In a modest apartment block in Bogota, Sandra and her young son wait for news. They have been waiting for almost 3 years. Sandra's husband was a soldier in the Colombian army.
Exactamente fue en octubre del 2008.
It was in October 2008. He was home on leave. Then he went back to his unit, and I never saw him after that.
Porque él estaba en otra zona.
Sandra believes her husband may have been taken hostage by rebel groups, but she doesn't know for sure, and the army can't or won't tell her. Today, Guillem Bravier, a protection officer with the International Committee of the Red Cross, has come to try to help her. But Sandra is just one of many cases.
There are so many, we don't know exactly how many. We know that it's an incredible number. Countless persons went missing because of the conflict over the past decades. Many families, thousands, tens of thousands, are still looking for them. And it's quite a terrible fight.
Él fue ascendido una vez desde el momento que desapareció.
Este año.
Sandra shows Guillem some of the dozens of letters she has sent, asking for information.
Sí, es bastante angustioso.
It's really hard. It takes so long. I've knocked at so many doors, talked to so many people, but I'm stuck in complete uncertainty. I hope he's alive and well somewhere, but I just don't know.
Sandra's husband is one of 57,000 people officially registered as missing in Colombia, and as increasing numbers of unidentified bodies are recovered from mass graves, Guillem Ravier knows that for many families, the search for a missing loved one may only end in the identification of remains.
So the bone is cleaned, then it's ground in powder, then they will keep only the part where DNA should be concentrated in.
A clinical analysis of a fragment of bone or tissue here at Bogota's Institute for Forensic Medicine. Outside the institute, families queue up for news. Inside, Director Carlos Eduardo Moreno and his staff are overwhelmed by their task.
The work is immense, and it's increasing all the time because of the conflict, the violence in our country. The number of registered missing is growing every day, and we're getting more unidentified bodies every day as well. We're working round the clock.
Es de todos los días, casi que pudiéramos decir de 24 horas.
Hundreds of families have now been told their missing loved ones are dead, but thousands still wait for information which, says Guillem Ravier, may be impossible to find.
Some families will never obtain an answer because for people who were effectively killed, missing people who were killed, we know that many bodies were really disappeared and will never be recovered. So the suffering caused by the uncertainty is very difficult to bear.
And for Sandra and her son, there is still no information. For them, the strain of not knowing has become intolerable. Any news would be better than none.
If I could just talk to him now, I would tell him how much I love him. He was my friend as well as my husband. We were together through good times and bad. I would do anything to have him back. I hope he's alive. But even if he's dead, I want him back.
But as the third anniversary of her husband's disappearance approaches, Sandra's search goes on. She doesn't know if her husband is alive or dead, if she is a wife or a widow, if her son will ever see his father again. A limbo of uncertainty which, for Sandra and many Colombian families, may never end. Imogen Folks, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bogota, Colombia.
Still to come on The World in Progress, a special report on the fight to get insurance coverage for victims of genital mutilation. But first, here's Holly Fox with some news about development issues affecting the world this week.
Delays in EU oil embargo on Syria. European Union efforts to impose an oil embargo on Syria suffered a setback on Tuesday when Italy asked for the sanctions to be delayed until the end of November, when existing supply contracts will have expired. Syria exported crude oil and petroleum products worth 3.1 billion euros to the EU last year, according to European Commission figures. EU officials say a ban targeting the oil and gas sector, a key revenue stream for President Bashar al-Assad's regime, would increase pressure on Damascus to halt its assault on pro-democracy protests. The planned embargo follows similar action in the U.S. Washington has imposed tough sanctions against the regime. In an executive order last week, U.S. President Barack Obama ordered the freezing of all Syrian state assets in the United States and forbade investments and exports to the country. World Bank grants $407 million to Kenya. The World Bank has pledged $407 million to help Kenya respond to a drought that has left millions in the country hungry. The money will be used to supplement existing projects in agriculture, health, and water and sanitation, and to improve resources management. Officials from the World Bank in Kenya said the funds would be directed to preparing for natural disasters and the improvement of food security, as well as the treatment of malnutrition. More than 12 million people across the Horn of Africa are suffering the impact of drought, and a famine has been declared in Somalia. African leaders also offer aid. African leaders have also raised more than $350 million in aid at a conference this week aimed at addressing the hunger crisis in the Horn of Africa. Civil society organizations said they were disappointed that just four African heads of state attended the summit in Ethiopia. But African Union leaders responded that attendance wasn't the issue, rather how much money was raised. This is the first time the AU has held this kind of conference. It aimed to meet the shortfall in global efforts to raise money for humanitarian relief. So far, the UN says half of the $2.5 billion needed have been raised so far. Australian government asylum seeker plan invalid. Australia's highest court has ruled against government plans for a refugee swap with Malaysia. The court said the plan was constitutionally invalid, as Malaysia is not a signatory to the UN Convention on Human Rights. Australia and Malaysia signed a deal earlier this year in which 800 asylum seekers would be sent to Malaysia for processing. In return, Australia would accept 4,000 refugees from Malaysia whose claims for resettlement had been accepted. That group includes people from Burma, Sri Lanka, Iraq, and Afghanistan. The swap was intended to help stem the flow of asylum seekers who arrive in the country each year.
That was Holly Fox with the development news. Our next report takes us to Berlin to meet a woman who survived a procedure called genital mutilation. This means the partial or total removal of a girl's genitals or other injury to her genital organs for non-medical reasons. UNICEF says more than 100 million girls and women worldwide have undergone this procedure, and another 3 million are at risk every year. Here in Germany, the practice is illegal and considered a gross violation of human rights. But there are women living here who have gone through it, and their doctors say they need treatment. Sometimes this means surgery, sometimes it means counseling. And that treatment isn't always covered by their health insurance. Lavinia Pitu has this report.
Akuvi is busy preparing a meal in her kitchen in Berlin. She holds her baby while cooking beignet, a specialty she often ate at home in Togo, where she was born. She has been living in Germany for many years, a place where she says she can have a normal life. Akuvi doesn't want to reveal her real name because today she is going to talk about what happened to her as a child, the day her external genitals were removed. It's a topic which is still very uncomfortable to her.
When they cut you, it's extremely painful. You are bleeding. There's blood everywhere, not only on that very day. The bleeding can last for a week. Some women die. And if not, the pain lasts for years. It actually never ends.
The mutilation of women's genitals involves partial or total removal of the female external genitalia for non-medical purposes. The cutting of the clitoris, for instance, is sometimes followed by the sewing together of the labia in the name of tradition. The procedure is meant to prevent sexual intercourse before marriage, or is linked to cultural ideas that girls become clean without these body parts. According to the World Health Organization, the practice is most prevalent in Western, Eastern, and Northeastern regions of Africa, some countries in Asia and the Middle East, and among certain immigrant communities in North America and Europe. The procedure is usually carried out on young girls. Traditional circumcisers, often family members, cut their genitals without anesthesia using improvised tools. Many victims die. Those who survive experience heavy bleeding, infections, or urine retention. In Akuvi's home country, Togo, genital mutilation was officially outlawed in 1998, and the government has made a series of efforts since to terminate the practice. But for her, it was too late. And for many girls living in rural areas like she used to, the situation hasn't changed, despite high penalties imposed by the 1998 law. The UN's refugee agency says one Togolese woman out of eight has undergone genital mutilation.
It wasn't my parents who did it. It was my grandma who was in charge of this. She said it was something they had done to all the girls in our family. So that was a reason to carry on. They weren't aware of what they were doing. They would organize real parties, rituals for the cutting. Meanwhile, the girls were screaming so loud, but despite the crying, the women were pleased to do it. They would tell us, "Now you are a woman."
I
According to Terre des Femmes, a Berlin NGO supporting women's rights, in Germany alone there live over 20,000 immigrant women who suffered genital mutilation in childhood. And even though they're living in a society that condemns this violation of human rights, it looks like their trauma hasn't really come to an end here. The president of Terre des Femmes, Irmingard Schewe-Gerig, says insurance policies in Germany generally don't cover the costs for medical care needed by women who have undergone genital mutilation.
So far, the insurance companies have refused to cover medical care for these women. They have been repeatedly shoved between doctors who don't know about the consequences of genital mutilation and the insurance companies, which wouldn't bear the costs.
Schewe-Gerig and her organization protested in Berlin last week, appealing to the German Ministry of Health to include in the symptoms of genital mutilation in health insurance policies. The reconstruction of the external genitals is often mistaken for aesthetic surgery, this being one of the reasons why the insurance companies refuse to cover the costs, says Dr. Christiane Tennard, gynecologist and head of the Balance Family Planning Center in Berlin. But reconstruction is not the only medical treatment that victims of genital mutilation are seeking.
They have pain when they have intercourse, they have pain when they have to go to toilet, they have problems to give normal birth. We speak first and then in a second session we work with mirrors so they can look and then I show them what's normal, what's not normal. We have more women with clitorectomy, where the clitoris is not there, the so-called total or pharaonic mutilation, we have very seldom here. It's very rare.
Terre des Femmes says the victims also need counselling to understand the full scope of what has been done to them, and that is a violation of their human rights. Many of them have undergone the procedures as a result of social pressure from their communities and because of fear of stigmatization and rejection if they do not follow the tradition. Akuvi knows she's different too. The memory of that day back in Togo will haunt her for the rest of her life. She looks at her baby with tears in her eyes. He's a boy, but should she ever have a girl, she says, would never do this to her. Akuvi will probably not go back to live in Togo. Still, her wish is that the new generation of African women, not only there, but also in other neighboring countries, fight for a change.
They will bring in the argument that this is our culture. Yes, we suffered, but it's over now, they would tell us. You know, our parents were uneducated people. They had no clue about the consequences. But we wouldn't allow this to happen to our children.
Lavinia Pitu, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Thank you to Lavinia Pitu for that report. The worst famine in 60 years is continuing to devastate the Horn of Africa. In Somalia, where the problem is most acute, nearly 4 million people are at risk of starvation. Around the world, governments and funding agencies are asking, how can we prevent this kind of suffering in the future? For years, development advocates have said aid in times of crisis is crucial, but more sustainable answers are needed to eradicate poverty and prepare nations to sustain themselves. An increasingly popular solution is investment in the private sector, especially agribusiness, so that food shortages can be prevented. Lars Tinel heads the International Finance Corporation, the private sector arm of the World Bank. We met for a chat at the Hotel am Wasserturm in the German city of Cologne.
We finance the private sector either through loans or through equity capital, risk capital. But also work a lot with trying to get banks to support small enterprises, small farmers and others.
And part of that work is also to create jobs locally. Why is that important?
If you look at the Middle East, for example, very often 50% of the population is younger than 25 years. They want an opportunity, they want jobs, they want to be able to sustain themselves and have a family. And it's not only the people that are not educated, even, you know, the unemployment rate in a country like Tunisia for university graduates is 25%. They want jobs.
Why is the IFC focusing on agribusiness as part of its effort to reduce poverty?
Well, you still have, if you look at the poor countries, most people actually live in the rural areas and they are engaged in farming one way or the other. It's a very important part of their livelihood. In the Horn of Africa, for example, you have people actually starving, and therefore it's also very, very important that we not only address the humanitarian issue that is right now, but also the structural issue of how do we actually increase food production and quality of food for the poor people. First of all, poor people are much more exposed to the increase in food prices and are really hurt by it. If you and I spend 25% of maybe our budget on food, normal family in the Western world, you know, poor people very often spend 70 to 80% of their budget or their expenses on food. So if food prices doubles, that really hurts them tremendously, and that's what you see right now.
You've said in an article that you wrote last year that aid is an important part of addressing these kinds of problems all over the world, but that it's not a sustainable answer. Can you explain what that means?
If when we see children starving, which is so terrible, we need to give them food now, and that's aid. But we also need to make these farmers sustainable, in other words, that they can support themselves. And in Africa, for example, 40% of the food that is produced is actually perish on its way to the consumer. So what you have to do is work all along that supply chain, everything from bringing in cars with refrigerated cars so they can take care of the milk and bring it from the farms to the cities so people can actually drink and doesn't get destroyed. So that's where we come in. We first of all try to work with that whole chain, with also food processing, you know, mills even distribution having good shops that actually have packaged food and so on.
I'm very interested in how you get people on board. So you not only have to get local banks on board, there have been big funding drives in the U.S. and Canada and all over the world. Could you explain to me how you convince people on the international scale to take an interest in IFC?
Well, I think on the international scale, if you take big companies like Syngenta or Nestle or Bayer, you know, that's part of their business, and they see the growth in the emerging markets going forward, because we're not going to have so much growth here in Europe and the United States. So they see a business opportunity, and more companies are now seeing that the bottom of the pyramid, as we call it, the poor people, is actually a business opportunity.
Okay. I'd like to know how human rights is addressed in your models for financing and addressing local poverty.
Well, we have had, first of all, our environmental and social standards are used by many banks and many international organizations. We're kind of the leaders there. And this is always a balance. There are some of the civil society in Europe and the United States who think we should go even further. And there are other people who are saying in the developing countries that we live in a reality where we have to find the right compromises. I think we take some steps forward that are very, very important. I think these have been accepted, because that's also very important, that our standards are actually being accepted by the people using it, like international banks and others. I think we have acceptance of that now. So I think we found the right balance and are moving forward. And let me just assure you that human rights, from our perspective, is very important. So that's not the issue.
A conversation there with Lars Tunnell of the International Finance Corporation. And that wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining us. Anke Raspa will be back in the studio next week. From today's Bonn studio team, Eliane Giarducci and Levlin Rechtenwald, I'm Saroja Coelho. Thanks for listening. Passera, la dernière restera. La dernière
se passera, la dernière restera. Passe, passera, la dernière restera. Passe, passe, passera, la dernière restera.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.